It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Leading up to and during World War II, the Nazis were responsible for the worst genocide in human history. In addition to murdering millions, they also perpetrated the greatest mass theft of all time. This hour, we're going to talk about that theft, efforts to understand it decades after the fact, and efforts to protect priceless artifacts during the war. With me now is former congressman, former chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Jim Leach. He's also a visiting professor of law and senior scholar at the University of Iowa. Congressman Leach, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, pleased to be with you, Sherry.
Also with me is Sean O'Hara. He is director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art. Hello, Sean.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming back to the show. And this is a subject that has been getting quite a bit of attention lately because of the movie The Monuments Men, which starred George Clooney. And we'll talk more about the movie in a little while and the fact that George Clooney portrays a character based on an Iowan who worked very hard to protect this art and architecture. But Congressman Leach, I want to start with you. When you were chairman of the House Banking Committee in the 1990s, you did extensive research on this theft. What started that investigation?
Well, it was part of a larger investigation, and it all started because I'd read a couple of obscure newspaper articles about the role of the Swiss banking system in World War II. The Swiss were the financial intermediaries for Nazi Germany, and there was some accountability right after the war, but it ends up that there was not a fulsome review. And so I decided as chairman of the banking committee to review not only the Swiss accountability, but our research quickly spread to a whole lot of other subjects. And at the end of the war, there were reparations of Germany, but they were quite modest in the sense that everybody knew that at the end of World War I, reparations had been called for Germany and that they were so punitive that the thought was that they helped precipitate the rise of Hitler. And so a very modest attention was put on the reparations issue. In addition, the scope and the awesomeness of the Holocaust was so great that it was virtually unbelievable. And there were very few witnesses because everyone was dead. And beyond that, you had a whole spectrum of circumstances. We knew that we were suddenly about to enter a conflict with the Soviet Union. We hoped that West Germany would be a bulwark against the spread of communism and of the Soviet state. And so the attempt was to be overlook some of the aspects of the Holocaust itself. The reason the 1990s became relevant was you had a conjunction of events. You had the end of the Cold War, you had the reunification of Germany, and you had the dissolution of what's called the Warsaw Pact, which was the Soviets' NATO. And in that circumstance, a lot of files were opened up, a lot of records were revealed, and these records went beyond the role of the German government itself to private institutions, not only banks, insurance companies, all sorts of commerce that benefited from the Holocaust. And in looking at these circumstances, one of the clear elements that developed related to the art, and you had the first real sweeping looks from art historians of the greatest displacement of art in history. And there were initial books by art historians like Lynn Nicholas called The Rape of Europa that had gotten attention in the public arena. And that book was more or less as a scope of subject matter replicated by a book that came out a decade later that called The Monuments Men that became the book that for which the movie eventuated. Now, the interesting aspect of all of this is that in history, we've never thought of art historians as central to war. But this all developed led by George Stout, the University of Iowa graduate. And George had become the country's leading art conservator at Harvard University at the Fogg Museum. And he helped precipitate a commission in Washington, D.C. called the Roberts Commission and Roberts being a Supreme Court justice, to look first of all at tactics, that is, what should America be concerned about not attacking in World War II, churches of historic magnitude, and that sort of thing. And then that eventuated into looking at the displacement of art itself. And so a singular Iowan became the singular figure in reviewing and then doing something about the review of everything that occurred in terms of art theft.
I know that there are probably still people who ask this question because of just the horrific events of the Holocaust, so many millions of lives lost. And so many of the victims of the Holocaust, of course, did not have great art collections. They were just normal people. There are probably people who say, why does this matter? I mean, the true tragedy was this loss of humanity.
Well, it matters in a number of senses. One of the senses is the tie between avarice and murder. When one looks at crime, sometimes one looks in terms of statute of limitations. And should there be a statute of limitations on genocide? And if you don't seek accountability, is it more likely to be a replicated crime? And so we had at the end of World War II, as everyone is aware, we had the Nuremberg trials, where a shockingly few people were brought in a legal sense to a kind of accountability. We never really had such a thing when you think of the lost assets. And people weren't thinking particularly of art at the time. In fact, maybe not even at all of art. But if you think of the lost homes, the lost businesses, the lost pots, pans, furniture, towels, what happened to them? And where did these assets disappear? Now, in the banking system, you had the issue that bank secrecy laws had been almost designed for people that were desperate minorities, like Jews were in Europe in the 1930s. And then they became a perfect mechanism to steal from people who were lost and from humankind. And in fact, the Swiss banks demanded offspring, for example, to present death certificates if they had a claim. Well, none were issued at Auschwitz.
Right.
And then you had the issue of insurance companies. No one paid benefits to people who were killed in the Holocaust. And were insurance companies getting away, in effect, with murder? And they were. As a spring off of the hearings we held and as part of the actions of the State Department at the time, led by an undersecretary of state named Stuart Eisenstadt, you had three commissions established, one led by Paul Volcker, a former Federal Reserve chairman, to review aspects of the Holocaust. You had another one headed by Larry Eagleburger, a former secretary of state who looked at the insurance company issues. You had another by a Swiss economic historian look at more intently at the Swiss accountability. And we ended up precipitating all of these events together, $6 to $8 billion of reparations to the then living Holocaust survivors who were now a diminishing number. And the Europeans wanted some cooperation in trying to, in effect, bring an end to everything by the turn of the century. And that was kind of a pushing timeline that everyone more or less agreed to because there were so few Holocaust people
right. That
would be around as the century turned. And so that was an understood goal.
There was also a dramatic shift in the 90s, of course, after the wall came down and there was so much more connection between the East and the West. Was that part of the push as well, that it was time to move forward into a new reality?
Well, in particularly with the reunification of Germany, Poland, where a disproportionate number of people were killed, the statistics are almost make you weep. There were somewhere around 4 million Jews living in Poland before the war, at the end of the war, and today. It's less than 100,000, maybe less than 50,000. Now, some of these people were able to escape, but very few as a percentage. And so you have awesome statistics. The same, and by the way, Ukraine is in the news today. And Ukraine had massive numbers of people killed. And not in the famous death camps, but just simply machine gunned down in side roads of small villages. This is one of the most awesome aspects of mankind's hatred of itself.
You spent 4 years doing holding these hearings. Were you shocked by the depth and breadth of what you found?
Well, anyone that looks at any aspect of the Holocaust has to be shocked. I mean, how one could perpetrate this kind of sin is just beyond human conception, and it is almost certainly the greatest sin ever perpetrated. And that doesn't mean that there haven't been other Holocausts. There have. We had an Armenian Holocaust in this century. We had Rwanda. We had Laos. Pol Pot. I mean, these are the idea of killing people for capricious reasons. I mean, Pol Pot killed people wearing glasses, because to wear glasses meant that you were interested in being literate. And that's it can be a pretty awful thing in societies that want to control thinking.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. And we are going to talk more about the life of George Leslie Stout, who was portrayed in the movie The Monuments Men. We'll be back in just a moment. With me now is former congressman and chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Jim Leach. Also here, Sean O'Hara, director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art. Later this hour, we're going to talk about the plight of mountain gorillas. There are only about 880 mountain gorillas left on Earth. I'll talk with Dr. Michael Cranfield, who is the co-director of a group called Gorilla Doctors, vets who go out and administer health care to wild mountain gorillas. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about some of the crimes of the Nazis. We've talked a little bit about, of course, the fact that the Nazis perpetuated the greatest genocide in history, but they also, at the same time, were perpetrating the greatest mass theft of all time. And that's what we're focusing on right now. With me is former congressman and chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Jim Leach. He's also a visiting professor of law and senior scholar at the University of Iowa. Sean O'Hara is also here. He's director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art. And I want to turn the conversation now to this individual, George Leslie Stout, who is a graduate of the University of Iowa. And he played a pivotal role during World War II in protecting some of this priceless art, architecture, cultural artifacts that could never be replaced. And Sean, Leslie or George Stout didn't only fight in World War II or participate in World War II. He also fought in World War I.
Yeah, he joined a medical unit in World War I, and he saw the destruction in World War I, and he saw what the opposing armies would do not only to people but to culture, because the war was on a number of fronts, as Jim said, including cultural. And he witnessed that. And the amazing thing with George Stout, and the reason why I think he's a great model for anyone, is that he had several careers, achieved an amazing amount in each of these careers, and then kept going. And in fact, ultimately, he was not known for his exploits in during war or to some extent even in conservation, which he was a leader in, but really ended to be a famous museum director in Boston. So, but as a typical Iowan, I think he probably didn't talk a lot about his past. So I think that's probably why.
Do you happen to have any of the drawings he apparently did here at the University of Iowa?
Well, we've seen some of his pictures. on an online database, but we've not actually tracked down any of his drawings.
Yeah, and his love for art was really awakened at the University of Iowa.
It was. I mean, I think he was a student at Grinnell, and he wanted to do art. They didn't offer art at Grinnell, and he transferred over. And he did art and English because, you know, it's the University of Iowa. So, and the University of Iowa, of course, was very big on art at the time. They had hired Charles Cumming from Des Moines as the art professor, the first professional artist as a professor. And so he studied painting and drawing. And then he was a lecturer for 3 years in the Department of Graphic and Plastic Arts, as it was known then.
Talk a little bit about his work in art conservation, because that is really – he moved into that area, not – in creating his own art, but into preserving and bringing back art that had been damaged.
He and another chemist at Harvard established modern art conservation. And I think people are sometimes confused at the difference between restoration and conservation. In the past, working on art meant repainting art. So you had pieces missing, you'd repaint it. And it was basically making it look better. What George Stout decided to do was look at ways that materials degrade, ways that you can stop the degradation, and then ways you can reverse that degradation. And those three principles were principles that he established at the Fogg Museum at Harvard. Actually, after looking at some cabinets being thrown out, I guess as a good Iowan, he was always looking at reusing things. And he noticed some cabinets being thrown out by the library, and he thought that he could use the cabinets to store material and watch them degrade. And he observed these materials degrading over years. I mean, it was a pretty big project. And ultimately, he established the foundations of modern art conservation. So his focus was on new ways of saving material culture.
How did he get involved in preserving art, protecting art during World War II?
Well, I think that, as you mentioned before, I think his World War I experience had something to play in it. I think he understood that countries would use culture, particularly in Europe, as part of their war strategy. And I think he noticed that the Germans using culture as part of their strategy by taking it or by destroying it if they can't have it. And there are a lot of famous examples at the time, you know, where the Germans were leaving an area and destroying everything in that they left so that the occupying armies can't have it. Particularly culturally sensitive items. I think culture meant a lot to the Nazis, and they were very keen on going to the heart of some of these cultures, destroying things that meant a lot to people. Like in Prague, for example, when the Germans were retreating, they decided to start burning down the city with the oldest building first. I mean, they were really very, very sensitive to that. So I think that George noticed a lot of this happening, and he realized that the U.S. Army and the British Army were not necessarily taking into account. Actually, it's kind of amazing because that happened then, it happened earlier, and it's still happening now. I think it's probably not a high priority for a lot of armies. But he wanted to make it that. And I don't think he was – I think with the Roberts Commission, I don't think he was – he tried hard. I don't think he was that successful initially. I think the director of the Met jumped in and helped – bring things along because, you know, at the time he was a kind of low-level conservation expert. And by the way, conservation was a pretty unsexy topic at the time. I don't think people knew much about it. But he was definitely a pioneer in that respect.
Oh.
Well, I just want to stress this. The irony of Hitler having had art training and the Nazis being interested in – they thought defeating countries by attacking their culture. In Russia, for example, one of the first targets was Tolstoy's estate, and they felt that the Russians would collapse if their great cultural leader was in effect I mean, he's long dead, but that if they controlled his estate, that would mean something very significant. And we'd never thought in those terms before. And so one of the both in terms of protection and then preservation, four people who lived there became our just instinct and that George Stout symbolized. And so George Stout, in effect, was more responsible than anyone to a tactical consideration in World War II, the last tactical consideration. And then by our returning things, it became the first salvo of the Cold War.
And the Nazis weren't just interested in destroying beautiful things. They were also collecting beautiful things for themselves, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Hitler wanted to build the greatest museum in the world in his home area. And he had this great dream, and we have the architecture of it, although it was never built. But this was all to be for the glorification of the Third Reich.
And we know that the Germans' interest in Europe was, you know, multifaceted. But one of the views, and it came out of World War One, was that, you know, why did these countries have all these wonderful things and wonderful food and wonderful lives, and you know, we don't, and we deserve to have this. And so they were, I think, what people don't realize or appreciate is that there was a kind of a tourist aspect to what was going on in World War II. When they took over countries, their view was we were going to enjoy these countries and we were going to enjoy their wine and we were going to enjoy. And so it was very material, but it was also, you know, there was a certain amount of tourism involved in a kind of nasty way. But
it was also the notion, and we in America can't even conceive of this, that in the 30s, not only were there burnings of German assets, I mean of German Jewish assets, but the burning of art that was not of an appealing taste to Hitler. And there were a lot of things that weren't appealing about some of the modern artists. Some they were critics of Nazi Germany, and some of the artists happened to be Jewish, maybe disproportionately. But art is an imaginative field, and so to modern art particularly. And so it's a thinking field, and the last thing a totalitarian wants are people that think for themselves. And so you have to destroy it. And they did some of it, and then others of it, they, as we've learned so much in the last couple of years, recognize there is some worth to it in terms of monetary value. They tried to market.
I think what Jim touches upon is an interesting issue, that this battle of ideas, the modern art, the abstract art that came out of World War II essentially, and which became an essential part of the Cold War in terms of the battle of ideas, you know, has its roots in issues like the Nazi Antarctica Kunst, the what they call degenerate art, art that wasn't considered, good enough, and having official art styles. The Americans battled by saying, you know, we can paint anything. I mean, if we throw paint on a canvas, it can be art, because in America, you know, we're about new ideas and about freedom. Whereas the Germans, the Nazis, and the Soviets, for example, prescribed art. So, I mean, art was a very central part of this war of ideas, as Jim said.
And the irony, of course, was in both Russia and China, these two totalitarian states, there were some artists that were leading the world in new fields. And in Germany, it was called Sachlichkeit, which means new objectivity, and virtually everyone in that field was anti-Nazi. In Russia, you had people like Malevich and L. Lazitsky that were into new fields. And with Cubism, which was 1908, lots of artists thought they had to develop their own new theories of art. And it's really theories of art are a 20th century phenomenon. And so between 1908 and the 30s, something like 20 new fields of art developed with really odd names. I mean, futurism isn't an odd name, but there are a number of isms that come from the art field, far more in art than in politics.
I'm talking with former Congressman Jim Leach and Sean O'Haro, director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art, and we're talking about the Nazi theft of art and priceless cultural artifacts during World War II. And it sounds like what you're saying, Congressman, is that we have something of a grasp on what was taken during World War II by the Nazis, but we may not know how much was lost.
Well, there's no calculation that is very precise. I mean, but we know if you use the concept for Jewish populations, the word that defines it is close to everything. And what that amounts to, no one has any idea. I mean, it is just so awesome to think about what it is that people have in life, whether it's a hovel or a castle. But there are certain fundamentals that attach to it.
It does bring up the point that what's left is that much more important. And we saved perhaps a small percentage, but that means that small percentage has to be, you know, focused upon.
Congressman Leach, you have spent quite a lot of time talking with groups about what you discovered in the 90s and about what we know now about that period during World War II and what was taken. Why is it important to talk about this now?
Well, there are a number of reasons. One, the fact itself of avarice in human nature. But it's also a lens into history itself. And art, which is the smallest part of this in terms of if you measure monetary value, but it is a reflection of culture. And so it has an intrigue to it that's very deep. And it's a barometer of an event. It reveals differences in legal codes. It reveals differences in societal accountability. It's embarrassing to some. What is wonderful about the Iowa dimension, very seldom do you have a circumstance that right is almost entirely on one side. And George Stout symbolizes the American who played a critical role in a critical way, who wasn't elected to anything, and then never, to anyone's knowledge, particularly bragged about this, his role. I mean, that this is one of the most honest men, and there's a famous interview he did for the Smithsonian of his life, and he hardly mentioned this. I mean, it wasn't – I mean, it was kind of like, well, you had the sense, my gosh, this is what good people do. And we found that a lot of people in the world weren't thinking the same way.
There have been, of course, many other conflicts in our history and many, many artifacts taken from cultures around the world. I mean, we've most recently talked about it with Afghanistan and with Iraq, and it happens again and again and again. Do you feel like the lessons from this have been learned?
Well, there are some things that have come out and that we've never paid attention to, and I wanted to bring a quote with me. And this isn't precisely George Stout, but there was a famous collecting point in Germany for the art that Stout and his group were finding called Wiesbaden. And at the end of the war, American museums wanted some of this art. And 202 pieces of German art were designed to come back to the United States. And the people at the collecting point thought it would be awful if they weren't returned. And so they wrote what's called the Wiesbaden Manifesto. And I'd like to read the opening sentence of it. And this was, in effect, an act of insubordination of the people who signed it, the idea of objecting to policy of military people. And the sentence reads, "We wish to state that from our knowledge, no historical grievance will rankle so long or be the cause of so much justified bitterness as a removal for any reason of a part of the heritage of any nation, even if that heritage may be interpreted as a prize of war." And that's a really profound thought. And these are art historians saying to the highest levels of the United States military, stop it. And so what in effect happened, this art was brought to this country and shown here and returned under a direct order of the President of the United States, Harry S. Truman. I mean, that's an incredible, phenomenal model to set for the country.
Congressman Jim Leach, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, well, thank you. We've enjoyed it. And, Sean, I'm honored to be with you.
Yes. Same here. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Sean. Sean O'Hara is director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art. Former congressman and chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Jim Leach, is also a visiting professor of law and senior scholar at the University of Iowa. In a moment, we'll talk about the plight of mountain gorillas. This is Talk of Iowa.